are in Nehemiah, and we're up to chapter 4. So if you want to go to Nehemiah chapter 4 in your church Bibles, that will be on page 488. 488. Just say small group notes there for those who need them. Let me remind you, you haven't been here, Nehemiah. He is news from Jerusalem through his family and through his friends that Jerusalem is still a pretty devastated city, and the walls are still broken down and the gates are broken down, and it's a pretty desolate place. And this really moves Nehemiah, and he's touched by this, and he goes to God in prayer. And in that time of prayer, God really gives him a burden and a dream and a vision to do something about this. That this isn't right, that this shouldn't be so. And he has this dream and vision to return to Jerusalem to, or not return, he's never been there, but for him to go to Jerusalem and to rebuild the walls and rebuild the city so it may be safe and secure once again. And we see that he has the courage to speak to the king. He's in the household of the Persian king. And he speaks to the king, and this ungodly king releases and resources a godly vision. It's quite amazing. It's a real miracle. And then Nehemiah sets off for Jerusalem. And we saw last week that God may give a dream and a vision, but in order for that to happen, to be fulfilled, for it to become a reality, it takes effort. It was going to take personal effort on Nehemiah's behalf and organized research, and it was going to take team effort. He couldn't do this on his own, and it was going to take sacrificial effort. Generosity was going to be required, and it was going to take that real sustained effort commitment throughout the whole task. So Nehemiah chapter 4. So when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became angry and was greatly incensed. He ridiculed the Jews, and in the presence of his associates and the army of Samaria, he said, "What are those feeble Jews doing? Will they restore their wall? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they finish in a day? Can they bring these stones back to life from those heaps of rubble, burned as they are?" Tobiah the Ammonite, who was at his side, said, "What they are building, if even a fox climbed up on it, he would break down their walls of stones. Hear us, O God, for we are despised. Turn their insults back on their heads. Give them over as plunder in a land of captivity. Do not cover up their guilt or blot out their sins from your sight, for they have thrown insults in the face of the builders." So we rebuilt the wall till all of it reached half its height, for the people worked with all their heart. But when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs and the Ammonites and the men of Ashdod heard that the repairs to Jerusalem's walls had gone ahead and that the gaps were being closed, they were very angry. They all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem, stir up trouble against it. But we prayed to our God, and we posted a guard day and night to meet this threat. Meanwhile, the people in Judah said, "The strength of the laborers is given out, and there is so much rubble that we cannot rebuild the wall." Also, our enemy said, "Before they know it or see us, we will be right there among them, and we'll kill them and put an end to the work." Then the Jews who lived there, near there, came and said and told us 10 times over, "Wherever you turn, they will attack us." Therefore, I stationed some of the people behind the lowest points of the wall and exposed places, posted them by families with their swords, spears, and bows. After I looked things over, I looked up and said to the nobles, the officials, and to the rest of the people, "Don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your homes." When our enemies heard that we were aware of their plot and that God had frustrated it, we all returned to the wall, each to his own work. From that day on, half of my men did the work, while the other half were equipped with spears, shields, bows, and armor. The officers posted themselves behind all the people of Judah who were building the wall. Those who carried materials did their work with one hand and held a weapon in the other, and each of the builders wore his sword at his side as he worked. But the man who sounded the trumpet stayed with me. Then I said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, the work is extensive and spread out, and we are widely separated from each other along the wall. Wherever you hear the sound of the trumpet, join us there. Our God will fight for us. So we continued the work with half the men holding spears from the first light till dawn, till the stars came out. And that time I also said to the people, have every man and his helper stay inside Jerusalem at night so that they can serve us as guards by night and workmen by day. Neither I nor my brothers nor my men nor the guards with me took off our clothes. Each had his weapon even when he went for water. Wow, it's exciting, isn't it? It's like an action movie. The theme of this morning, as Andy said, is kingdom building will face opposition. The reality is if we're going to get engaged in building God's kingdom here on earth, then we will face opposition. Not we may do, not we might in the future, we will do. It's pretty guaranteed. And last week we saw that the enemy could cause disunity, that was one of his weapons, if he could cause disunity amongst God's people, then that would help to stop the work of God going forward. But we saw that he didn't, and they became a team, and they began to think about this work and to start this work. So the enemy's, he doesn't give up easy. So his next strategy is this, that if he can't bring disunity, then he will try and bring discouragement. Discouragement is another one of his weapons where he uses it in order that we may lose hope and give up whatever it is that God has called us to do. And in this story, we see that this discouragement comes in a number of different shapes and forms. Firstly, there's this external discouragement that came through ridicule. In fact, it starts even before here, even before the building work starts, when Nehemiah goes to tell the people what he's going to do in chapter 2. In verse 19, we read this. When Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, and Geshem the Arab heard about it, they mocked and ridiculed us. So even before the work was started, they were beginning to attack with their words. And it says, when Sanballat heard that they were rebuilding the wall, he became angry and was greatly incensed. He ridiculed the Jews and in the presence of his associates and the armies of Samaria, he said, what are those feeble Jews doing? And these questions he puts down, you know, will they rebuild this? You know, are they really going to turn these stones which are burnt and broken? Are they really going to rebuild the walls? And he's being sarcastic. He's mocking. Occasionally I go to football. And years ago, they don't do it so much now, but the away fans, when the home fans, when the away team used to come onto the pitch, they used to chant, who are you? Who are you? Who are you? And they didn't chant that because they were genuinely interested in finding out who these people were. They weren't doing that. It was they were saying, who are you? You're nothing. You're nobody. We don't even recognize you. We're going to whip you today. And it's the same thing with Sanballat. He's saying, you know, what are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore the wall? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they bring these stones back to life? And his thing is, no, of course they weren't. And he's trying to make them feel bad. And that's what the enemy does. He comes to ridicule. He comes to mock us, doesn't he? He comes to taunt us. You know, there's that phrase where it says, sticks and stones will break your bones, but words will never hurt you. What a load of rubbish that is, isn't it? To be honest. And I know, I understand that words can't physically break your bones, but some of the words that we speak over one another, or some of the words that are spoken over us, have caused us to stumble and fall. And have caused us to stop and not to move forward in the things that God has had for us. Especially when we're young and we're growing up. You're no good. You'll never amount to anything. You're rubbish. You know, things that people have said over us. And, you know, our tongue is powerful. We need to be careful how we use it. We can use it for good or we can use it for bad, for blessing or for cursing, as James said. But the enemy loves to mock. He loves to ridicule. And he comes in and he taunts us in lots of different ways. And, you know, did God really say that to you? Is he really going to use you? Let's be honest. Come on, look at you. Would God really want to take a risk in using you to further his kingdom? Just the lies and the accusations and the taunts of the enemy. How did Nehemiah respond to that? Verse 4. He says, "Hear us, O our God, for we are despised. Turn their insults back on their own heads. Give them over as a plunder in a land of captivity. Do not cover up their guilt or blot out their sins from your sight." It's not quite what you'd imagine, is it? Certainly when you get into the New Testament, you know, Jesus is saying, bless those who curse you and do good to those who, you know. But I think this is not a personal attack that Nehemiah's. He knows that if these taunts succeeds, that the people will lose heart and the plans of God will be thwarted. So he said, no, this is not for me, this is for the kingdom. Andy, in the first week, we were looking at that kingdom building begins with prayer, and he used a quote from John Piper, which said, "You only know what prayer is for when you know that life is war." And Nehemiah knew this was a war. And he was prepared to use warfare tactics. And he prays in that way. But he doesn't just pray. Then in verse 6, "So we rebuilt the wall until all of it reached half its height, for the people worked with all their heart." So these taunts, this mockery didn't stop them from moving forward. This ridicule, they carried on despite the things that they were hearing all around them. But if Nehemiah was going to think that this was just going to go away, discouragement comes to us in different shapes and forms. It's reoccurring. You would have experienced that. You know, you get over one thing and then you're feeling good, then all of a sudden something else comes along to discourage you. And this time, it's intimidation. It said in verse 7, "But when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs and the Ammonites and the men of Ashdod heard that the repairs to Jerusalem walls had gone ahead and that the gaps were being closed, they were very angry. They all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem to stir up trouble against it." This was real intimidation. They were then saying, okay, if the words are not going to be enough, we're coming down there. We're coming down to sort you out. Anyone ever had that? My dad's bigger than your dad in the playground. It's like bully tactics, isn't it? I still have these words in my head years ago. I've shared the story once before, but I had a slight altercation with someone in Reigate High Street once. And I wasn't in a position really to do much, and I thought I'd best run, which I did. And then I managed to find sanctuary in a grocery store. And this guy comes in there, and he stands at the door, and he looks at me, and the owner of the grocery shop says to him, "I think, you know, you need to move on, otherwise I'll call the police." And the guy just looks at me and says, "I know where you live, Pozzo." And those five words just like shook me for weeks, for months, intimidation. "I know where you live." That's all it was, the words intimidating, "I'm coming after you." You know, you may have thought you've escaped this time, but I'm coming, I'm not letting this up. Intimidation is real, it's big, and the enemy loves to intimidate us and to try and to create that thing where we just think, okay, I'm not going to do anything. There was a program, a drama on the telly over the last few weeks called Little Boy Blue. Did anyone see it? Little Boy Blue is a true story about an 11-year-old boy in Liverpool who was shot. Dead, murdered by a 16-year-old boy. And it was all to do with turf gang warfare and drugs and all that sort of stuff. And the boy he's in the wrong place at the wrong time, and he gets shot and killed. And the whole thing, it is shocking how everyone knows who it is, who's responsible, and the people behind it. But the intimidation is so severe that no one wants to say anything or no one wants to come forward. And that's what the enemy's like. He does it. He creates an atmosphere of intimidation. He's a bully. Next, we see that the discouragement isn't just external, but it's also internal. In verse 10, we read, "Meanwhile, as all this is going on, the people in Judea said, 'The strength of the laborers is given out.'" In verse 6, we know that they started well. Because it says, so we rebuilt the wall till all of it reached half its height. They're halfway through this project. For the people worked with all their heart. They had a good start. They were full of motivation and they knew this was of God and they started really well. And they got half of it done. Then all of a sudden, this intimidation comes and they begin to lose heart. They begin to get tired and weary and fatigued. The strength begins to sap from them. It's no coincidence that it was all wrapped up in all the emotion as well as the physical fatigue of it. And, you know, they kind of looked around and they suddenly thought, well, you know, we started this building, this wall, but we're only halfway through and we're already worn out. Have you ever started a project and you start with great gusto and then halfway through, you kind of just get tired of it? When's this ever going to finish? Or have you ever run a race? We've had a few guys who run marathons, haven't we? You ever feel like quitting in the middle of it? I'm told that when you hit 20 miles or something, that often you hit the wall. And it's hard to keep going. We've got a little video clip going to come up. Some of you may recognize this clip. It's an athlete called Johnny Brownlee, and he's a triathlon. And which is where they cycle, they swim, and then they run, just for good fun. And in this clip, he is ahead, and he is going to be crowned world champion. He has just 5 kilometers to go. You got any sound on it?
Title. And right now he seems to have lost control of his legs, and this is worrying. Oh, and he's starting to slow, and there is a little way to go. There's half a K to go, and Johnny is running out of time and is losing. He's losing his sense of direction. This is worrying. Oh, goodness me. This is a horrible sight. Jonathan Brown.
Fantastic. He is so close to the finishing line. He is so close to the finishing line. And yet, all of a sudden, he's exhausted. Fatigue hits him. And it hits him so hard that you can see he's literally, I mean, I've never been like that because I've run for lots of, but I have. In the way distant back, I kind of remember something like that. And he's gone. He is gone. He's absolutely gone because he is fatigued. He is worn out. And it just seems he can't go on. It's interesting. We had, I don't want to put it quite in the same context, but we had a finance meeting on Wednesday night here. And we were looking at the giving to the church, and we were assessing the general giving and the giving to the building project, and we were looking at the effects of more manner and all kinds of things. And we were reflecting on the building project that started many, many years ago, but in particular 9 years ago when we really started ramping it up and putting this vision forward to do this. And for the past 9 years, people have given generously and sacrificially to this project. And it's cost £2.5 million to redo this building. The new parts, the renovation. And we were encouraged that on Wednesday, we are down to £90,000 from £2.5 million. We can see the finishing line. But do you know what? In that meeting, it felt like we were beginning to stumble because it's been for so long. And people are given generously and sacrificial. It's hard work. It's great when you start because you've got the momentum, you've got all the excitement, and this is what's happening. And we've got this vision to pay it off in 7 years of being back in this building, which will be next September 2018. The finishing line is in sight. But it's painful. It's painful. And there's a sense where in the spirit and our general giving is down. And this is not, this is not a finance talk, okay? But I'm just telling you where we're at as a church, and we will be speaking more about it in the coming weeks. But it's kind of like this sense where we've been running so well and we've been given so generously that all of a sudden we kind of begin to, where it's taken effect. That's what fatigue does. But it wasn't just the fatigue. When you're tired and when you're weary and you're in the midst of that, suddenly frustration cuts in. In verse 10, it says, the strength of the laborers is given out, and there is so much rubble that we cannot rebuild the wall. They lost their focus for a moment. With all this intimidation, with all these attacks upon them, and with their tiredness, with their fatigue, all of a sudden, all they could see around them was rubble. They couldn't see anything else. They could just see the rubble. They were right in the middle of it, and it was just a building site. They couldn't see anything further. They couldn't see the end product. They couldn't see what God was doing. And negativity began to creep in. And they actually say, there is so much rubble that we cannot rebuild the wall. Not that we might not. No, no, we cannot. They've gone from saying, yes, we can do this, to suddenly saying, no, we can't do it. That's discouragement. Where they've completely, they're about to topple. They've lost their vision. Johnny Brownlow, he lost. He didn't know where he was. He's tottering. And these guys, through discouragement, they are on the edge. But that's not the end of it. In verse 11, it says, also our enemies said, before they know it or see us, we will be right there among them and we'll kill them and put an end to the work. Fear. So they come from fatigue to frustration, and negativity sets in to fear. They're going to kill us. We're finished. Why did we ever start this project? And this whole negativity stuff comes in. You ever seen that? Have you ever seen that actually happen in a team or in a workplace or in church or whatever, where all of a sudden, when it doesn't quite go right, and let me just say, when you're doing God's will and God's plans, that doesn't mean that you won't have problems or pressures or setbacks, okay? But when it's suddenly you have a setback, that people suddenly go, see, I told you. I knew that we should never have done this. I knew that it was too much. It's too painful. And negativity can come in and fear can be created. You know, you see right through the scriptures where God says, do not fear, do not be afraid, do not be discouraged. I am with you all the way. And when we're building for God, he is with us. You see it most powerfully when God said to Moses, I'm going to give you the promised land. And Moses sent the 12 spies out into the promised land. And they all came back in agreement. This is an amazing land. It's a land that's flowing with milk and honey and incredible treasures. But there's a problem. And the problem is that the people who own that land, they're giants, they're massive, they're huge. You know, and we're just like mere grasshoppers in their sight. We're tiny. There's no way we can do this. God must have made a mistake. Only two out of the 12, Joshua and Caleb, said, come on, we can do this. God said it, so we can do it. Let's go in and take it. But the 10 stirred up the people so much with negativity that they rebelled. And they refused to go in. And, you know, they spent 40 years wandering around the wilderness because of that disobedience. 40 years because of fear. What was going to happen to Nehemiah? Was it another project that was going to be shelved? What was his response? How did he encourage the people? The first thing he did was call them to prayer. In verse 9 it says, but we prayed to our God. In verse 14, he says, don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who was great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your homes. You know, he's encouraging them to get their eyes back on God, who is the architect of this building project. He's encouraging them where they've lost their focus. And he said, look, come on. Don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who was great and awesome. He really encourages them to pray and to seek God and to trust in God in the midst of that. Secondly, he calls them to the partnership. He says, fight for your brothers. This is like his Braveheart speech. Fight for your brothers, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your homes. You know, this isn't just, okay, we're just going to pray. We're actually going to do something. We're going to act. As we saw the other way, faith and action go together. He says, we're not just going to lie down. We're going to do something. Fight for your brothers. We're in this together. We need one another. Can we have another look at the second part of this clip? So this is Johnny Brownlee, just about to give up because he had no other choice. And this is what happens. If he wins this, he wins the world championship.
He has lost it now and has staggered to a stop at the side of the course, and Alistair's stopped to help him along. And Alistair is going to try and carry his brother home. Dramatic scenes in Cozumel as the Olympic champion carries his younger brother towards the podium.
Oh my God, I cannot believe what we are seeing here, Matt. Is this allowed? Is he allowed to help his brother? You know, is that part of the rules? I'm not too sure. We've never seen anything like this before.
Unbelievable scenes. Unbelievable scenes in Cozumel. The Brownlee brothers arm in arm, but it's not by way of celebration. Henry Schumann's celebrating. He's going to win this race in Cozumel out of nowhere. But we have to be concerned about the health of Jonathan Brownlee. And they're not even on the final stretch yet. Schumann wins in Cozumel. The brothers are coming home arm in arm to finish in second and third. But Johnny can hardly stand. And Alistair is having to drag him across the line and pushing him home for second. Johnny finishes in second. Goodness me. What an incredible conclusion here in Cozumel.
Is that not quite amazing? I mean, they're brothers, okay? So, of course, they're going to have emotion for one another. But, you know, the younger brother, if he'd won it, he didn't win it. So if he'd won it, he would have been the world champion of that for that moment. But the other brother, he could have won it because he was in second place. But he chose to stop and to carry his brother. And that to me is amazing. You know, he realized that we're in this together. You know, this isn't about individual, you know, we're team, we're in this together, we're brothers in arms, as it were. And this is what Nehemiah's saying. He said, you know, remember the Lord who is great and awesome, fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes. He said, this is about partnership, this is about doing this together. And thirdly, he encouraged them to persevere. In verse 21, it says, so we continued the work with half the men holding spears from the first light of dawn till the stars came out. They continued the work. They persevered. They didn't give up. It's so easy when we feel discouraged just to give up. And that's exactly what the enemy wants. And yet God wants us to stay focused, to stay at the task, not to give up, not to quit. The Prime Minister Winston Churchill in October 1941 was invited to speak at Harrow School. And they were excited about this. They were all looking forward to it. All the pupils and the staff and the parents were there. And Winston Churchill was invited to come to the podium to speak. And everyone's thinking, you know, this is fantastic. He's a great orator. And he gets up and he says to each of the young people there, never, 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 ever give up. And then he sits back down. And that's it. And they're all looking, my goodness, this is inspiring. And that's it. And that was his message. It was the shortest speech he probably ever made. And I was thinking of doing it myself. And I would have thought you'd have said a few hallelujahs there. But, you know, he made his point. Young, old, whatever, never give up. Hebrews reminds us of that. Hebrews chapter 12. It says, therefore, since we are surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race that is marked out for us. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and the perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. And let us consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, that you will not grow weary and lose heart. If we're going to be involved in kingdom building, then we will face opposition. But let's not lose heart. Let's keep on keeping on. Amen.